using gravitational lensing because that's what I've been involved in recently. There are other ways of doing it. And that will fit very nicely in with Sergei's talk earlier. I very much hope to be able to talk about detecting structure on small scales, because I think that's a strong feature of CDM, one of the highlights of the theory in a way, and it's something we only realized or started thinking about maybe 2 years ago. I decided to skip the details of how nonlinear structure formation works inside halos, and we might get to that if there's time. And then I thought it was essential to have at least one inflammatory bit to this, so the last bit will be the inflammatory bit. Okay, so large scales, what's really the frontier in mapping dark matter on large scales? It's probably the quest for more precise results. So one way to map, one very nice way to map the mass distribution is through gravitational lensing. You have mass in some plane, and if you go looking at an object in a source plane at higher redshift, rather than seeing a given angle, you expect that angle is distorted to some different angle that you see. So you get some deflection, which you can write in terms of a sort of thing like a potential, which involves this surface density in the lens plane. So fundamentally, you're measuring the mass distribution in a single plane. When you work out what angle you finally see, so in terms of observables, you actually see this thing kappa, which is the surface mass density divided by a critical mass density, which depends on the redshifts of your setup. So you can tune this effect to pick up different redshift slices by picking different source planes, for instance, which make you more or less sensitive to different lensing planes. And typically, what you might want to do, for instance, is pick a source plane that's at twice the angular diameter distance of your lens plane, and that's how you'd get most sensitivity to the lens plane you're looking at. Yeah, so I'll get on to that. So this is a very idealized system. You can imagine this in something like a strong lens, where you have one galaxy being lensed by one object, so it's clear what the distances are. Yes, normally you would know, or it's generically easier to figure out. I guess it depends a little bit what you're mapping, but certainly, for instance, if you're mapping mass around luminous objects, typically because they're at lower redshift, it's easier to get a distance, an accurate distance to this. And then typically you can't get a good distance estimate to your sources. You have to guess what those distances are. So that is an uncertainty here. But let me, so how do you actually use this technique to make maps of the mass distribution? So if you imagine just a point mass overdensity in some region or some small overdensity localized in some region, what you'll see is a tangential distortion. So an overdense region will produce a pattern like this in the shapes of galaxies behind it, assuming those galaxies are distributed with random orientations to begin with, right? So it'll shear all their shapes tangentially. Conversely, if you have an underdense region, what the angular distortion winds up giving you is a radial pattern. So you can just go looking for these two patterns in your map, and there's a nice sort of consistency check or systematic check, which is you don't expect any B modes from lensing just from the mass itself, right? So you can go and measure the amplitude of that, and that gives you some idea of what the systematics are. Unfortunately, the effect is very small, so you need to do this over hundreds of galaxies. So it's typically a 1% effect. And this means that making actual maps isn't always the best way of doing this. Sometimes the best way of doing this is to do something like correlate the shear of pairs of galaxies on different scales and measure that statistic instead. But you can actually make maps which show you something like the surface mass distribution or the gravitational potential distribution in a given plane. And the one other problem is that this this function is a very broad kernel. So in fact, you're actually picking up signal from a huge range of stuff. And you're not, well, you're sensitive to stuff halfway between you and the source. It's not a very peaked sensitivity. So how does this relate to cosmology? If you think of a 3D power spectrum, you can project that down and imagine the mass fluctuations you would see along a given line of sight. So that's this quantity here. This is the fluctuation you get in kappa. And this is like the 3D power spectrum, and this is then like the dimensionless version of the power spectrum, where there's a different power in S here because it's a projected quantity. And you can see that you expect on large scales to measure the linear power spectrum, that's these faint curves, and on smaller scales you expect to start picking up the nonlinearity from structure formation. So this is a low redshift version of very well matched to measures of the power spectrum from, say, galaxy simulations. So because the signal is so small, when people started doing this initially for the first 5 or 10 years, there were huge systematics and groups disagreed widely. Now there's nice convergence, so these are a whole bunch of independent measurements which all get consistent results with error bars. You can start to believe this is on a slightly different statistic. This is the shear variance. And as I was saying, it's more effective in practice to measure these other statistics of the shear field. But ultimately, you're measuring the same thing. You're measuring moments of the mass distribution. So the thing that's more on the frontier, the more ambitious thing, is actually to try to, rather than just measuring this projected quantity, to try to draw out the third dimension. So the way you could imagine doing that is, for instance, measuring the signal you get to sources in one redshift plane and the signal you get to sources in the other. And you might think that that would tell you about the mass in between. So if you see, for instance, strong convergence in a direction when you go to higher redshift, that must mean that mass is sitting between these two redshifts. And there are a number of problems with this. The first is you're not very sensitive to objects close to your sources. Basically, for simple lens geometry reasons, you would have to bend the light rays very sharply at either end of the light path to have an object like this produce lensing back here. So you're less sensitive here. The amplitude of the kernel goes down. And more generally, the shape of the whole kernel to, let's say, this slice versus the shape to this foreground slice, this has variations along the whole path. So in fact, if you do this sort of differencing, you're actually picking up contributions from everything along line of sight. Plus differences are always noisy anywhere. So I probably shouldn't show you this slide because essentially the conclusion of this slide is, you know, you have to take the 3D maps I'll show you in a moment with a real grain of salt. Nonetheless, being brave and proceeding with this observationally, so this was work done in the Cosmos survey. This looks like a completely blank field, larger than the moon. It's 1.5 square degrees on the sky. It's actually not completely blank on my monitor. You can see there are some galaxies in it. So this was a large survey done with the ACS camera on Hubble just before it sadly died. We're hoping it may get fixed next year. So it's the largest contiguous area that's ever been imaged from space. And the original idea was that from space you'd get a very high surface density of galaxies with very accurate shape measurements. So you'd really get a sort of unprecedented lensing data set. And some of that came true. So in particular, there are, within this region, there are several million galaxies you can get good shape measurements for. And another feature of this survey, so this was something that was worked out initially from other smaller surveys, that you can actually do fairly good redshift estimates with much less information than you would need spectroscopically. So typically, you know, the back of the envelope calculation is that getting the spectrum of a galaxy to get its redshift takes about 1,000 times more telescope time than measuring photometry for it. So if you can get an estimate of that redshift from, let's say, 10 or 15 independent photometric redshifts, you're winning almost a factor of 100 in time. And that's what was done in this survey. So we got photometry in, when I made these slides, we were up to 15 bands. I think we're now up to 18. And the number keeps going up. We're actually getting more and more photometry. It's photometry in the near infrared in particular that's very important for breaking degeneracies and getting accurate galaxy redshifts. So the redshifts now look a lot better than this. This is plotting the photometric redshift that you guess from having photometry at different broad wavelengths, so you get a very crude estimate of what the spectral energy distribution looks like, compared to spectroscopic redshifts where then galaxies have been selected at random and followed up spectroscopically. And this gives you some idea of what the redshift resolution might be like in these studies, right? So for what we're doing, this actually isn't too bad. If you can get redshifts accurate to about 10% or so, then you're actually picking up a lot of the crude cosmological information. So one way of thinking about that is if you're looking for, say, dark energy variations, those don't change very quickly with redshift. So in fact, you only need to be able to place your galaxies in a small number of slices, 3 or 4 redshift slices, to get a lot better constraints from lensing on the growth of structure. If you wanted in the future to do precision cosmology where you ruled out, say, time-varying equations of state at the percent level, then the big concern, you'll never reduce this scatter to a very small level. There are fundamental limits on how accurately you can get these redshifts without actually going and measuring the galaxies individually. The big concern is bias. So you'd be very concerned if you found that at some redshift, your redshifts were a few percent above or below the average. So there are clusters in this field, and there's large-scale structure. So I don't actually have a plot of the number distribution of galaxies, but it's very uneven in this field. The main thing that actually limits the cosmological constraints in this field is that it's actually a tiny field from a cosmic variance point of view. So, you know, we pick up 1 or 2 massive clusters at high redshift. So that's why you get all these things.
Struck by
these things,
photometric redshift.
Right. So some of those come from, this I understand much less about, but the main power in photometric redshifts is things like picking up the 4,000 angstrom break. And as your photometric errors get worse, you essentially lose resolution linearly, because what you're doing is measuring that break, that sharp break in the spectrum, moving back and forth between two filters. So you expect a sort of linear change in color as you go back and forth, and then if your photometry gets bad, then you just smear things out. So I think that's where most of this is coming from, and I think the reason you pick it up more at some redshifts than others is just has to do with the you know, convolving the spectra with the photometric errors.
There's a systematic bias that your photometric disease are bigger than the spectroscopic, namely many more points lie above your line than lie below.
The errors are skewed.
Yeah. This, I should say, is not a, I don't think this is reflective of the five. So our errors don't get down to 2%. I think currently they get down to about 3%, though. And this plot is quite, I think, reflective of the latest data. But that is a concern. You actually want, depending on what you're doing with lensing, you may want that. You may want to put, so unfortunately for lensing, the effect is asymmetric. If you can easily scatter some, you can scatter some high redshift galaxies to low redshift, which is a problem because you're then picking up a sort of anomalous lensing signal at low redshift. The low redshift galaxies basically shouldn't be lensed at all. So you kind of want the error, you kind of want to push the galaxies up by default, and then try to measure how much you're doing that and say you're just diluting the signal. Basically, if you add extra low redshift galaxies to the high redshift bin, it just dilutes your signal, but it doesn't. Whereas if you do the opposite, then you've got bigger problems. But So doing this in practice, you take this beautiful catalog of several million galaxies and you start doing cuts to see which ones have poor photometric redshifts in particular or other problems, poor shape measurements, and you actually wind up throwing out more than half the galaxies doing this. So we're down to 40 galaxies per square arc minute, whereas the original hope was to get 100. You need about 100 galaxies to make a measurement at some signal to noise, you know, one or two or something. So that tells you the area over which you can make maps, basically. And you then just have root n statistics over the noise in that number. Just to show you roughly what the maps look like, this is maps done in different redshift slices, just to show you that if you then go and look at what the light distribution's like in those slices, you get a rough correspondence, but not an exact correspondence, right? So there are differences between the mass distribution and the light distribution. There were, just to mention very briefly, the original idea was to do this from space, where because you don't have any atmosphere, you know, you'd hope that measuring shapes would be much easier. It turned out actually that one of the limiting effects or systematics in the detector and the telescope, and that from that point of view, it was almost harder doing this from space than it was from the ground, because you can't know exactly what's going on in the telescope, and you certainly can't correct for it. So in particular, the main problem that was found in these studies was that the focal length of HST is changing very slightly with time. For some reason, that is to do with thermal forcing, but it's not. You would have to do a complicated thermal model to you know, get any sort of prediction. So eventually, we came up with this wasn't really my work. This was before I started working on this, but Jason Rhodes especially came up with a sort of empirical correction for this. Once you take out that term, then you find the next systematic. So this is the next systematic. This is charge transfer efficiency. So you have a silicon detector sitting in space getting zapped by cosmic rays, which produce defects. The defects trap charge, and as you read an image out across the detector, the charge stays behind, and you get trails behind each of the galaxies, which of course systematically distorts their shape in a horrible way. So this is a measurement of that effect, and you can see at least that it's easy enough to understand. Luckily, the map was done with the chips all oriented the same way, so it produces a coherent effect along one particular axis, and you can try to correct for that. So this is sort of before and after that correction. But there are all these really nasty imaging corrections you have to do to get to the final result. And then the final result, we argue, is fairly good. So one way of looking at that, this is actually the map rotated on its side just to fit on the image, by the way. So that's why the features look like they're in a different place. This is the real kappa modes, the E modes, and these are the B modes, the systematics. And you can see that basically, and these are on the same grayscale. So it looks like these corrections have got rid of most of the systematics in this. Having said that, these detections, just in terms of shape noise, are still only, well, they're 4 or 5 sigma detections, which in a sense statistically would be very good. But there are 4 or 5 sigma detections of things where you can have 1 or 2 sigma or 0.5 to 1 sigma systematics for a range of reasons, including physical reasons like projection effects. So I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. So if you just look for cosmic shear in this, you get a nice result. These bins are actually a bit correlated, so that's why this result looks so nice, because it's smoothed out a little bit. But still, you get nice error bars in this case on sigma 8, the amplitude of the power spectrum, so going from 0.7 to 1.2, and you get an answer around 0.8 from the 2D measurement here. But of course, I'll get to that later because it's more interesting. The 3D one's more interesting. So, but the really interesting thing to do is to try to do this tomography, where you compare different slices and try to correct for the kernel and determine where the mass is coming from along the line of sight. Right. So this was the result of a long analysis by Richard Massey trying to do this. And this is sort of our best estimate of what the mass distribution in this volume looks like. Because it's a 3D thing and you can rotate it around and make a movie, we had a press release and so on. I think at some level it is a great achievement, because if you get any resolution at all, even say in three bins along this axis, you're gaining tremendously in information and constraints about the power spectrum. Having said that, if you look at this carefully, you can start to think of some problems. So one thing is the resolution's much poorer back here through a combination of photometric redshift errors and also just having fewer galaxies. You need, of course, to measure the mass here, you need galaxies back here behind them. So you lose those things above redshift 1, 1.5. These contours cover huge areas, so if you compare them to the voids we were seeing in the previous talk, these structures are far too big physically to correspond to well-defined filaments. They're really smoothing on much larger scales. That's particularly true in the redshift direction, where the real axis ratio for this plot, if you did it in co-moving coordinates or something like that, would be something like 50 to 1, right? This is really a pencil beam survey. So you can see that this map, although it looks like you've taken a small volume and really drawn contours about where the potential is in detail, you know, there's a lot hidden in this. Yep.
Resolution. If I pick any of those small blobs,
yeah.
How much do they extend
redshift? That's a good question. I think this was done in slices of about 0.1 in redshift. I think that's what Richard did. So, I mean, you can find, which is huge, right? It's, you know, whatever, hundreds of megaparsecs. You can find, of course, well-defined structures in the optical. So you can find clusters and things and start putting in these things. These contours are also, in a sense, fairly low contours. They're not densities corresponding to collapsed structures or anything. They're just smoothing over the density field on very large scales. I think, really, the information in this is probably that this bit's more grainy than this bit, and that effect is real. It's not just...
So you can interpret this as a density contour, the mass.
That's right.
Density would this contour that our surface correspond
to? That's a good question. I mean, my guess is it's an overdensity of a few, so it's not, they're really not collapsed, you know, they're things turning around or, so I mean, that's another way of thinking of this hierarchy of structure, right, that walls you expect an overdensity of 5, filaments you expect an overdensity of 20 or 30. Three things collapse in 3D, you expect densities of 100 or 200. And actually, we sort of use that argument to say these things are or aren't.
Like, so I don't know about this moving around. So basically, if I take the slice in front, because that's where we first see voids appearing.
Right.
To what redshift will that correspond?
This, I think, is out to, I think this whole thing we did out to redshift 1. I think we stopped. You get some information beyond that, but it's pretty noisy. So this here, you don't get much information below about a redshift of 0.2, because geometrically it's very hard for mass to, you know, the light's coming in, it has to be bent very sharply to get a lensing effect, so you're just less sensitive to.
But if you're guessing, as far as I go out in redshift, basically you smear, some systematic smear the density distribution out in a way such that I'm not sensitive anymore, basically, to voids.
Right.
Is that a fair statement? Or?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the windowing function, or the sort of kernel or whatever you're applying here in angular terms is also different from the one here, right? This is a cone, so it's going on. So, in a way, maybe the most interesting thing about this figure is how misleading it is, and how little relationship it bears to anything. But it does, nonetheless, you know, kind of give you a systematic idea that there is some information in here, it's just not the information.
How many megaparsecs is that in depth? About 100 or?
Sorry?
How many megaparsecs in depth is that cube?
This, it's on the order of 1,000 or 2,000, and then it's, you know, something like 10. Yeah, so the axis ratio is something like 50 or 100 to 1. So this is a very distorted, you know, in other words, across this volume, you're picking up cluster scales or scales separating clusters along this volume, you know, you're picking up everything. I mean, it's just sort of, and so really the only effect you'd expect to see here is sort of cosmological evolution. But let me go on to that. If you want to use that to measure structure growing, then in a sense that's an even worse inversion problem because you're picking up, I mean, structure's growing from high redshift down to low redshift, but as you go to high redshift, you're picking up the lensing contribution from everything at low redshift. So the thing works exactly backwards from what you'd like, that, you know, to measure the weakest signal, you have to subtract off the strongest signal. Having said that, we tried to do that. So we tried to measure the lensing signal in slices and just made the very crude assumption that that was all coming from material at the halfway point where you're most sensitive. The reason you need to do that is you need to figure out what angular scale you're looking at, because otherwise you're looking at different angular scales. You know, if you measure shear correlation on a fixed scale, sorry, you're looking at different physical scales at different redshifts, right? So to decide what physical scale you're looking at, you have to pick a redshift and say that's contributing all the mass. If you do that, this is time, cosmic time, so from 7 giga-years to the present day, and this is then some corrected measure of shear correlation, corrected for the fact you're looking through this longer and longer path, so you're picking up more and more material. And the only thing to notice here, and there's some theoretical curves, but the only thing to notice here is just there is a trend upwards. So you do pick up a statistical signal of structure growing from early times to late times, which is sort of interesting. What's maybe more interesting in the short term or more useful is just that by adding the redshift information, you get tighter constraints on parameters. So the error on sigma 8 was sort of almost 0.2 if you just looked at the 2D data. We get a high value of sigma 8. The WMAP value was more like 0.75, I think. So this is a bit higher with a large error in 2D, and then when you go to 3D, you can reduce those uncertainties by a factor of 3 or so. And you can imagine that just because you're taking several independent or semi-independent projections of the power spectrum at different times. So you can actually use those to... So here's the plot, maybe. So this is a more recent analysis. This then combines the Cosmos lensing data, which is this banana, and it really does, in this case, look quite a lot like a banana. That's maybe going around a bit or something. So you get a nice combination. If you combine that with, say, line half, you get a nice combination of small parameter space, which is at a bit higher amplitude of the power spectrum than the WMAP favored value, but it means you get a very nice small intersection between the two. And if you believe both of these things and think they're both measuring the same thing, then formally you can get a very small error. You could get a sort of, you know, 2% error on sigma 8 or 3% error. And you get also constraints on the power spectrum. So let me talk very quickly about something else, because this is trying to get back to the frontiers bit of this, since you know, power spectra, weak lensing, shear measurements, and so on are things that have been done for a while now. And you know, there's a sense in which once you do believe that there aren't big systematics, we're maybe already almost getting to the point where we can stop caring what the answer is in these measurements, right? I mean, if you really believe this error bar,
it's not clear that you need to measure sigma identity better than that. Is there a reason you want to measure sigma identity better than
that? Douglas is gone, right? But I mean, this, it is funny to give up at that
point, too. But when I look at this,
it doesn't seem, you know, isn't it going to take a flat-out miracle for weak lensing to contribute to a smaller error bar here?
I think the errors get a lot smaller. There are two issues here. One is what kind of test you're doing with it. And also, I think the errors get a lot, I mean, this is a very crude implementation of 3D, so. I think there's more room maybe in this method than others compared to Lyman Alpha. I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether the Lyman Alpha results could get substantially better in the next 5 or 10 years. So I'll just show quickly one sample. This, as it turned out, is a completely crazy thing to think of doing. So this is how the signal varies if you take a lens at a given redshift and put a galaxy behind it and ask how much does it get lensed as you move it further and further back, right? You change the source redshift. So here, this is for three different lens redshifts, and this just shows how these curves then depend on the equation of state, and they just depend on this through geometry. There's no growth factor in here. So this is a purely geometric test that a number of people have suggested. I put up these references because one of the authors has the same last name, so it looks like I wrote these papers, but I didn't, in fact. So you could imagine going and trying to measure this. This is basically measuring how the angular diameter distance varies with redshift. And here's the size of the effect you're looking for. This is minus 5% here, plus 5%. So I've taken a baseline cosmology and then a bunch of variants around that. And that shows you, you know, you expect sort of for reasonable variations in parameters, you expect a kind of on the order of 5% variation in how this angular diameter changes. Unfortunately, the thing you actually calculate, the ratio of distances, is a smaller signal. So here it's below, for lens at 0.2, it's below a percent, substantially below a percent. So if you were going to do this, you would really have to trust that the mean of your photometric redshifts was good to that level. And that's the big concern in the field, is how small can you make the error on the mean in photometric redshifts? You know, can you get down to 10^-3, for instance, or not?
Errors were very asymmetric.
Exactly. So that's the big concern, and it's an interesting problem because it's, you know, this messy mix of what galaxy spectra actually look like with can you do anything mathematically to get rid of the catastrophic failures and so on. Just to show you, the one nice thing about this is that different models, right, give you, I mean, constant W naught or varying W and so on, give you signals that look quite different. In particular, constant equations of state different from -1 give you something nice and detectable. This sort of variation, unfortunately, doesn't. So you get very little sensitivity to a time variation, which was not quite what I expected. And this just shows, well, you can just move this to different redshifts and get slightly more optimistic results as you go to different redshifts, right? The nice thing about this is you cancel out any mass dependence, any profile dependence. This is just a ratio of shears behind your object, however massive it is. So it doesn't really matter whether you do or don't know what's producing this signal. You know, it doesn't even have to be dark matter. It doesn't have to be anything. This is just a purely geometric test. So I actually went and looked for this in Cosmos. I went and found clusters. We have X-ray coverage of the whole field. You can go through the X-ray images and look for extended diffuse sources. Those correspond to optically selected galaxy clusters and groups in the field. This is kind of a map of a whole bunch of them. And then I cheated. I went and looked at the lensing maps and found cases where you clearly see a nice lensing peak sitting on top of a nice X-ray cluster, just to see if you could see this effect at all. And I think you can in some cases. So I've just drawn in these curves to guide the eye, that there are cases where you see a rise in the shear behind the object starting at about the redshift you expect with signal to noise of something like 1 on the order of 1 for, you know, maybe half a dozen clusters. That's one of them.
Unfortunately, I made the mistake of showing this last week at a lensing conference, and they pointed out that it's very hard to explain this drop. So I have to go back and kind of look at systematics in this. But ideally, what this shows you is you have some level of shear in the foreground looking along one line of sight, and when you hit the cluster, it jumps up, and you get a 1 or 2 sigma measurement of signal from that cluster. If you do this for the half dozen or so clusters, then you can produce an incredibly accurate precision cosmology constraint on the equation of state, which says that it's -1, plus or minus about 1, but that error bar may not be very accurate. It might be +/-2. This work's actually been done more accurately by Thomas Kitching and Alan Heavens and collaborators, and they've done it with the Combo 17 survey, smaller field, but also with PhotoZs, and they get a similar result. They get a result of about -1, +/-1. So this is something that in the future you could imagine doing in large lensing surveys, tens of thousands of degrees, and then you get errors that start to be interesting mainly on this quantity, right? Sort of percent level errors. Okay, let me talk very quickly about 1 or 2 other things you can do with the lensing, and then I'll really try to move on. So one other thing you can do is all these peaks are detected at some significance, right? And of course, there's now a lot of interest in the significance at which lensing peaks are or aren't detected post-bullet cluster. So you can ask, you know, what does it mean if I detect a 3 sigma peak in a lensing map? So what it means is that there is the corresponding probability that just at random shape noise in that map would produce that peak. Okay. So it is a 3 sigma result showing you there's something there at a 3 sigma level. Unfortunately, it doesn't, because of the lensing kernel, it doesn't tell you where that thing is along line of sight. And if you're trying to relate it to a mass you might predict from structure formation, that's usually a 3D quantity. And the relationship to the 3D quantity, so the relationship between the peak you measure and the mass of a cluster, which is something you might want for, let's say, cluster number counts, has systematics in it at the half to 1 sigma level. And this is just an illustration of this. What I did here was I took X-ray masses from clusters detected in Cosmos and assumed they were absolutely correct, which is, at this level of precision, a reasonably good assumption. And that means you can put them on a mass versus redshift plot. And then you can put in the expected lensing contours, the sensitivity, where you'd expect to detect things at 1 sigma, 2 sigma, 3, 4, and so on up to 8 sigma. I should say out here, the sensitivity depends very strongly on whether you do or don't believe the photometric redshifts that are placing galaxies at redshift 2 or 3. So that gets back to this asymmetry problem that, you know, you get very different results. Some of those galaxies, there's of course a much larger number of galaxies at low redshift than at high redshift, so it's easy for those to get scattered to high redshift. So you might not believe the numbers of galaxies you think you see there, right? If there are more galaxies there, then in a sense you might be sensitive to some of these objects. So what this shows you is that we expect at a kind of 3 sigma level to be sensitive to about half a dozen clusters. And then there are a number of groups on smaller mass scales where you could add together the signal. It adds together linearly. So you can stack all the low stuff here, and they're all, you know, 0.5 or 1 sigma things. So you can add them all together and get quite a nice result. And in fact, that's being done by Alexei Leotsov. I'll show you one of her plots in a moment. Well, some of the systematics cancel out if you add them together. So one of the systematics is that the halos aren't round, and you get large scatter, 0.5 sigma scatter, in how high you predict the peak should be for a given mass, depending on just which way the thing's oriented. So if you stack a bunch of things, then you get, you know, a radially average projected quantity, which yeah, so if you've got systematically incorrect redshifts for these, that would, I guess, I'll show you a profile in a moment. I think the error that would make on the profile is it would change your amplitude and your scale a little bit. I'm not sure if I don't think you'd worry about, I mean, in a sense, it's the shape of the profile that's interesting, so I'm not sure if it would affect that. I put on this in small, totally illegible numbers, I'm not sure why. The significance at which these things are actually picked up, and these ones are actually picked up at about 2 to 4 sigma, but there is quite a big scatter up and down. It's interesting that the high significance ones are not picked up at very high sigma, which raises another problem, which is you have to remove the cluster galaxies from your sample of source galaxies, and the cluster galaxies bleed into the source sample. The cluster galaxies are not being lensed by the cluster because they're in the cluster, right? It's only things behind it that are being lensed. So there is a dilution problem. So, I mean, the bottom line from this is there are many, many problems. If you want to pick up clusters and measure masses accurately using lensing, there are a whole set of different problems. A big one is seeing this is the same thing for ground-based survey, where the observing conditions vary and you get very different sensitivity between the red points and the black points. And that's split by, that's the same survey, same telescope, but just split by how good or bad the seeing was. And the seeing wasn't varying by much here. So just to show you some lensing profiles, so going down further on that plot and adding things together, this is the average signal you get stacking around, in this case, galaxies. These are, I think, bright ellipticals. This is preliminary work by Alexei Liotow, which should come out shortly. She just emailed me this plot, so I probably shouldn't even show it to you. the interesting thing here is you're actually picking up different contributions to the mass, right? There's a baryonic contribution you're probably not picking up yet. It would only come up here, and you don't really have signal-to-noise to see it. There's what's called the one halo term, which is the average mass distribution about galaxies, whatever causes it. And then out here, there's the two halo term, which is how galaxies and galaxy halos cluster together, right? She argues there's actually a third term here, which I don't understand.
Just from the shape. Okay, so I mean, you don't separate it yet because there isn't enough resolution. So this is how the surface mass density varies, right? So that's what you measure. You measure an excess surface mass density. This is versus log radius. Okay, so you don't currently have signal to noise on the optical position of the galaxy itself. But if you get to that point where you're getting enough signal to noise close to the galaxy itself, you can, in principle, measure whether this curve, this black curve, is consistent, say, just with the green curve, or whether you need an extra contribution. So here it does look like, in the last two bins, you need a bit of an extra contribution at a half a sigma level. But basically, if you can measure the black curve, the excess surface mass density, right, then you can say, well, we see the baryons, so we know there's some mass there. So we subtract that off. This is a very simple isothermal model.
Baryons or galaxies? Because
well, the baryons you see, you don't know where the others are, right?
So there's a smooth dark matter profile, but then also dark matter profiles because these galaxies, right? That would give you something like that. So
the galaxy includes stars. Okay, it includes other baryons you can't see. You don't know where they are. It includes dark matter around that galaxy, and then that galaxy is clustered with other things. So you have at least three contributions you know about, and you could have others like other baryons you can't see. Right. So you know there are some baryons in these things because you see them. You see the stars, and that gives you this red contribution. Right, and then the rest of this is telling you that's what the rest of the mass distribution looks like, or what the mass you would infer using GR and applying it to this lensing deflection looks like. Whatever explanation.
How do you know that that green curve is sufficiently boosted upwards in that previous plot?
You don't have signal to noise to know that. So that's that's what lies in the future. What lies in the future is getting better bins on this, right? I mean, you can go out into the field. This is an excess. So you can go out into the field until this excess goes to zero, at which point you can't boost it anymore, right? But you can also tighten the error bars on this to the point where you start seeing differences, for instance, between spirals and ellipticals, which would be another way of knowing you are actually picking up the bearing on some of this. Anyway, I'm going to spend a bit too much time on that. So, So, just in summary, from the lensing, you get these broad constraints on cosmological parameters. There are other tests, independent tests you can imagine doing with the lensing data to constrain parameters, and you can start comparing the properties of individual structures, galaxy clusters or galaxies, with things you see in visible wavelengths like the X-ray or like models of how galaxies occupy halos. So let me go through this very quickly because I do want to spend at least 5 minutes causing trouble. So maybe run over a bit. So the other completely different thing I'm interested in, which I think is interesting just from an inflation point of view, is perimeter on this, is what happens on the very small scale end of the spectrum, not the large scale structure end, but the small scale. So if everything's made of dark matter, what are the initial conditions in that? What are, for instance, the smallest fluctuations? So the smallest fluctuations, to solve that, you have to know what the power spectrum is in the dark matter on very small scales, and that comes from this physics where WIMPs at beyond some, below some redshift, reach chemical equilibrium. They take longer to reach collisional equilibrium, and this really is what damps out fluctuations, whatever fluctuations were there in the distribution at earlier times. So there have been many calculations of this. I don't know if Mark's still around. He maybe isn't. Anyway, he did some work on this recently. All these calculations basically come up with the same bottom line, which is that you expect the transfer function from these processes to cut off the spectrum of fluctuations on some scale, which you can relate, say, to a mass scale. And the results you get, depending on how general a calculation you do, are something like 10 to the 4 solar masses down to maybe 10 to the minus 12, sorry, 10 to the minus 4 solar masses down to 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. These are like planetary masses or smaller. Okay. So this is the bit of the power spectrum we're used to applying, you know, modified gravity or inflationary models to. This is the bit of the power spectrum you care about for small-scale dark matter. You care about all this bit here, which, of course, is completely free of features because it's unobserved, and things that are unobserved are, by definition, free of any interesting features. This power spectrum, if you take the dimensionless variance, gives you this funny prediction that, on the one hand, has no features, so you'd expect the structure of dark matter to look exactly like those simulations we were seeing earlier, just scaled down to smaller and smaller scales at higher and higher redshift, right? You wouldn't expect from this anything unusual to happen. If you work out the dimensionless power, though, there's this funny thing that it goes flat. So for a long time, there was an argument that this changed structure formation substantially because it meant that hierarchy broke down. You didn't have a strongly varying mass scale. It turns out experimentally that is less of a problem than people thought. Basically, you always still have peaks in the density field. Those peaks no longer have a well-defined mass at a given time, but those peaks still nucleate structure formation, and structure formation still proceeds through mergers. So there are some simulations of this. This is one of them. This is going down to a particle mass of that samples a cutoff at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. Right, so you do a simulation, you pick a little box, you go back to the time when that box is linear, you realize it with more particles, you do the same thing a couple of times, and you get down to this tiny mass scale where the individual particles have masses of 10 to the minus 10 solar masses each. Right, so the interesting thing about these simulations, which were done by Jörg Diemand and the Zurich group 2 years ago. So the interesting thing about these simulations, the surprising result, is that they produce absolutely no surprising result. They produce exactly what you would expect. You see filaments in these smaller boxes. You see small, roughly round halos. And the halos have both the density profile
that big halos on large scales do, and they also have the number, the abundance that halos do from something like pressure hector theory, very roughly. So in fact, it looks like we actually understand what structure looks like right down to the 10 to the minus 6 solar mass level, or whatever level you want to stop at if you have a different favorite particle, yes.
Careful, you know, simulating these small scales, because if you just go back, you see this regular structure, and this actually suggests that these halos are seeded by shot noise, you know, that they reflect the initial grid and initial condition.
But yeah,
I completely agree with that, and
that's actually, that's a serious problem with one dark matter.
It's like the same problem that you actually come to say.
Yeah, no, that's true. This here is a
regular structure of halos there that might reflect
I mean, some of that's a little bit real, right? There is in things like pressure hector that really happens. But yeah, no, I agree. That's certainly, I mean, I think it's more just interesting, you know, these profiles and so on. It tells you you can at least try to do calculations in this regime, and the answers are interesting. So that was what I tried to do. So the problem with then making a simulation where you actually incorporate this small-scale information into something to the side of the Milky Way is that nonlinear structure information is mixing things on all sorts of scales, and you have to resolve the largest of those scales to solve the problem so consistently. So basically, you can't do it even with, you know, this is the largest simulation of something like the Milky Way we have, and the tiny little lumps here are 10 to the 4 solar mass things, right? So they're orders of magnitude above this scale or more, the scale we're interested in. So I was trying some semi-analytic calculations of this, where you look at the density field, you identify upper dense regions, you say how they merge together, right? That gives you a merger tree, so this is pressure hector theory. There's this problem that you can't actually build merger trees to arbitrarily high resolution. You just run out of computing power. So I was playing around with sampling these things sparsely, and you then have to think about how you do that. But it's kind of fun because you can make models where you try to follow the formation of the Milky Way and track what halos contribute to it. So this is the mass of the main halo. This is then the mass of the things merging with it. And with these sparse trees, I was sampling down to tens or thousands of solar masses. That was one run. Tried this again, going down to, in this case, 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. This is a sort of semi-analytic model, but it gives you some sense of what might happen to these things. In particular, they lose mass once they merge. They lose mass maybe by a factor of 10 or 100, which is interesting for direct detection calculations. The concentrations are typically low. The final concentrations, they've lost all their outer envelopes, so they're really just stripped cores with r to the minus 1 profiles. And there's a radial dependence in their properties. So I think we're still digesting all of this. So we're still digesting what all this means to, say, direct detection. There was a claim this year that if you do the full calculation, it's very hard to ever hope to detect individual lumps like this. But in principle, you might, for supersymmetric dark matter, you might hope to detect them through annihilation. Right, so you might hope to see individual lumps nearby. You could also potentially, if there were very small C signals in direct detection, where the flux of dark matter through your detector is varying because you have this very lumpy structure locally. The timescales for that are long; they're decades or centuries. But let me just—I really want to get on to the inflammatory bit. So let's just see if I can do that. So this is Mon versus modified gravity. So one thing I think nobody's talked about explicitly, but or maybe they have. Sorry, I also had to teach this week, so I had to miss a lot of the talks. But that, you know, there are these two different ways of testing, you know, of a given theory. There are two different ways of testing a given theory of cosmology. There are geometric tests, like the distance to supernovae, or the distance, the angular diameter distance test I was showing you. Baryonic acoustic oscillations, trying to measure volumes, and so on. And then there are growth of structure tests like the ISW effect, cosmic shear, cluster number counts, and so on. So these two tests are, in a sense, just both ways of measuring the expansion history
because the expansion history from the Friedman equation gives you the growth factor. But that's assuming standard gravity. And if you, and there was this nice, I mean, my introduction to this was a nice paper by Eric Linder that, that was just pointing out that you can make models that completely match the expansion history to essentially arbitrary precision, but that have a very different growth factor. So this is a case where he was looking at DGP models and just showing that you can make, you can basically mock up some model which exactly matches if you only think about the expansion, but if you then allow for the fact that the Friedman equation is modified, you actually get, you know, a 5 or 10%, so a measurable difference in the growth history. So having those two tests is the important thing, right? Having at least one geometric test and at least one growth factor test. So this is totally random. This was something I was reading, and I was thinking about dark matter and modified gravity, so I thought this was kind of interesting. This is from a book called The Golem, which is a book on the history of science. It's actually a book I sort of disagree with, but it takes these test cases out of, you know, things like, well, they're interesting. They're a mixture of things like cold fusion, where the result is very controversial, and but also things like Eddington's trip to observe the eclipse and confirm relativity, which is not at all controversial. So what the authors point out is that if you read textbooks, you get descriptions like this. This is from some guy named Pauli, that make it sound like this experiment was carried out and it was absolutely conclusive and you know, there's no reason. I mean, basically, there you go. The theory's proven, right? And this was how the press then interpreted. I mean, this is not that over the top a statement. This is how it comes out in the press. Right, revolution in science, and so on. This is the data. Okay, so this is the data from the observations of the deflection of light. There were three independent measurements, two telescopes at a site in Brazil, and one in Principe. This was the one Eddington was actually at. It's very hard to interpret the statistics. Basically, they were trying to measure deflections on photographic plates. It's very hard to do. The weather wasn't great, and so on. There's scatter in the individual plate results, but these are sort of the best estimate as to what error bar you would put on those measurements now, right? And the point is, you know, this is the relativistic prediction. This is the Newtonian one. You know, it's not, I mean, you wouldn't maybe send that to Nature right away nowadays, right? Okay, maybe. I don't know. Maybe you would. Just in case, I mean, I'm not a relativist, so maybe I'm missing something here, but this bit I do understand. This was one of the original, I'm not sure if it's the original, but one of the original plots of Hubble's law. Okay, and similarly, it's pretty brave to draw a straight line through that. So the conclusion, the it's interesting to think, why were these theories accepted on the basis of really crummy evidence? Because objectively that evidence is, you know, is crap. I mean, it's just not very good. And yet these were radical theories that involved completely rewriting everything. So why were these theories accepted on the basis of such limited evidence? So, and here's where I'm going to be inflammatory. So I'd say, you know, traditionally we always discuss theories as if what mattered with a theory was whether it was likely to be correct or not, and that's what we should fight about. But the argument in this book, and in this much at least I do agree with the authors, is that you can never do this on the frontier of science. You never have good enough data. You know, by the time you have good enough data to prove to skeptics that you're right, it's 50 years later. And he pointed out, for instance, that with the Michelson-Morley experiment, there was confusing and you know, uncertain data up until the 60s. And basically, I mean, as I don't know, some experiment must have superseded that since. But that issue was not resolved, you know, for a skeptic for 50 years, right? So what I'd argue is that, in fact, it doesn't matter whether the theory is likely to be correct statistically or not, that, you know, a good theory is one that allows you to move forward. And that the reason this crummy data was accepted was because people knew perfectly well what was waiting in the wings. What was waiting in the wings was a whole new way of envisioning things that made new predictions. So from this point of view, to have something like CDM, I've never understood this. You know, people talk about crisis in CDM, too many dwarf galaxies, all these things we don't see, it must be wrong. My reaction is that's the most attractive feature of the theory. Imagine a horrible theory that told you that what you observe now, galaxy properties, is all there is. Right? I mean, we can all pack up and go home. So it's attractive that CDM predicts dark structures that we have not yet seen and that we could someday see. Right? That's very attractive. And from this point of view, my criticism to modifications of gravity, I mean, this may be a little unfair because I know when you come up with an alternative theory, you by necessity have to spend a lot of time initially showing it's not ruled out, and therefore you get all caught up in this issue of whether it's ruled out or not. But for me, you know, the question is not are these theories ruled out or not, it's what can we do with them? What exciting new things can we do with these theories? What do they tell us about problems? So, well, first of all, just obviously you have to check the theory isn't ruled out, and the way to do that, which I think we're getting towards, is to, you know, calculate the CMB spectrum and make sure it matches. From that, calculate what growth you expect. Go to lower redshift and make sure you match the fluctuations at lower redshift. Make sure that the growth that matches this also gives you the right expansion history, which we also measure. So, you know, make sure this whole prediction between geometry and growth is consistent. So you've got a consistency check. So by the time you've done this, you know, you're fairly constrained. It's worth pointing out that sadly, even after you've done this, none of these tests constitute a prediction of the theory, right? Because these are all things you can already do in CDM, and things like the shape of this power spectrum was a prediction before it was observed, right? I'd also say that you know, if it's too hard to do any of this in the theory, it's not a good theory on the grounds it's too hard to do any of that. So what do you really, you know, what's the exciting stuff I'm waiting for modified gravity? I think it's probably mainly this one, right? Where are the missing baryons? We only see a third to a half the baryons we know have to be there from nucleosynthesis. So it's great to take at a naive level, you know, rotation curves and say, using the visible matter, we reproduce the rotation curve in a given theory. And I don't, you know, I don't pick particular theories, but that's certainly something that has happened for 20 years now. Those are only maybe a third of the mass in that system, and we don't know where the rest of the mass is. So it doesn't, I mean, this is like the eclipse measurements. It doesn't matter what sigma you measure them to, because you don't know where two-thirds of the stuff is. And arguments based on sigma alone are never going to convince me. One way or the other, I mean, they're never going to convince me, you know, in a sense you can't prove dark matter this way either, right? There's just this freedom that we don't know where the baryons are, and you have to explain where they are. You actually have to explain where they are dynamically, because they probably go through galaxies. You know that, for instance, because in the IGM, things are enriched with metals, and also galaxies have a lot of angular momentum, which it would be hard for them to get if they had less than the pool of baryons to draw on. So there are arguments that galaxies have processed most of the baryons. If the baryons are what produce the gravitational potential, then how do you get rid of them once you've assembled them into a self-gravitating structure? In dark matter, it's easy because they're not actually producing most of the gravity. So you can read the rest of these and go to lunch. So, thank you.
That's a discussion for us. But question on weak lensing?
Yes. One of the things you introduced was the notion of detecting a mass to temperature X-ray gas relationship.
Right.
And when you look at the sigma map for the X-ray, for the bullet cluster, mm-hmm. one of the things you determine is that it's a remarkably isothermal gas sphere.
Right.
And so in this particular instance, the dominant source of gravity towards the dark matter has been shifted from the actual gas.
Okay.
So why don't you observe any imprint of this sweeping away of all that matter directly onto the temperature profile of the gas mass. It looks remarkably isothermal. There's no skew in the direction of the automatic. And the merger happened at least 100 years ago. So why don't we see any imprints of the dark matter on the gas mass?
Well, my impression was the shock is reasonably well modeled, so you do see the shock. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, once you try to subtract the shock off and look at whatever's left underneath it, then that's a good question. Would you expect a big effect or not?
And once you do that, you can model the main cluster without the subcluster as a remarkably isothermal gas sphere.
Yeah, so like, you know, in the dark matter picture, part of the explanation for that is, of course, it's totally dominated by the dark matter, which is relatively unaffected by the collision. So the mean potential of the gas fields hasn't changed. And the
gas in the dark matter is spatially dissociated by megaparsecs.
Sorry, the potential is not
So the potential around the gas has changed drastically, and yet the isothermal profile is still very isothermal, very...
Right. Once you subtract off the shock, so once you subtract off all the bit that's doing something, then the bit that's not doing something looks smooth. I totally agree. I mean, my take on the bullet cluster is you'll never resolve the issue one way or the other because it's, you know, it's a 4-5 sigma thing. And all you would have to do is find, let's say something along line of sight, and it doesn't make the effect go away, but it reduces the 5 sigma to a 3 sigma or whatever. So I mean, that's why at a certain point I stopped following that discussion because I felt this is as good an example as we'll ever get, and it's, to me it's inconclusive. But I don't know, maybe you have a different
people from Washington. A recently scholar of my collaborator, Rick McClung, and when we fit the mass power spectrum with MOP, then we're using only baryons, the transfer function comes from the baryons, proportional to Bessel function. So when we actually get a fit to the data, there are wiggles, especially around scale.
Right.
Right. Whereas the dark matter, of course, is still with the pressure. It's a smooth curve. So what we need is better resolution for larger scales. You pick up these windows.
That's exactly, I agree completely. No, baryon oscillation measurements will give you that. So if you can predict that to 1% or better, you know, and say this is the prediction, you know, we've committed to it, then there will be measurements that can test that. You know.
This is a real signal.
Yeah, I agree.
So at lunch, just one announcement, we're going to start at 3:30 exactly. We're going to start half an hour earlier. Let's thank James again.